come up on a tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is Mike Sachs, who just came out with a new book called Poking a Dead Frog, a collection of interviews, advice, anecdotes from comedy writers, the country's best comedy writers, writers for The Simpsons, for Saturday Night Live, stand-up comedians, including incredible people like Mel Brooks. And this is an absolutely fascinating read, because one of the things that he's doing is he is essentially arguing with this book that comedy is a writer's medium. And if you are a writer, whether you're a fiction writer or a poet, you want to read this book. It will help you with your writing. It's a fantastic book, and I'm glad to have him on the show. I've been doing research on humor lately because I'm working on a book about it, and I'm teaching a humor class, and I came up with what I call the theory of puns. You may notice that comedians, stand-up comedians, don't use puns very often. And if they do, they might use maybe one per show. Like if it's an hour show, they might use one. And puns get groans. They don't get laughs. I have a theory as to why. A pun is a half a joke. Conventional joke structure, a joke subverts the anticipated meaning of a statement. For example, Steve Martin says, I believe that sex is one of the most beautiful, natural, wholesome things that money can buy. When we get to that money can buy, it completely subverts the original meaning, that sex is beautiful, natural, and wholesome. It negates the meaning completely. I'll give you another example. Henny Youngman's famous joke about marriage. And he says, take my wife, please. And I'll give you another example. Stephen King's joke. People are always asking me where I get my ideas, and I say, I have the heart of a little boy in a jar on my desk. Again, it's a complete negation of the original statement, I have the heart of a little boy. So that is a joke, but a pun doesn't negate a statement because a pun still relies half on one meaning and half on another meaning. So that subversion isn't very rewarding for the person listening to the joke. I'll give you an example. Here's a pun. I used to want to be a banker, but I lost interest. Oh, groan, right? There is no subversion of an original idea. Rather, lost interest has half a meaning about the banking term and half a meaning about not being interested anymore. But it doesn't completely negate one or the other. It relies on both. In fact, it really doesn't make sense. I'll give you another example. A bicycle can't stand on its own because it's too tired. Oh, is that horrible? That's groan-worthy. Too tired. It means two things. It isn't a negation of one. Broken puppets for sale. No strings attached. Ah. So, the theory of puns. A pun is half a joke, and that's how come you don't actually laugh at it, but you groan. And if this theory sounds a little bit like a similar theory from the physicist James Clerk Maxwell, who, by the way, used to love puns and would, him and his scientific team would always make puns in the laboratory. Well, I'm borrowing this theory of puns from him and applying it to joke structure because he was talking about puns in terms of analogies. I'm really interested in jokes, but I'm also, as you know, I kind of dabble a little bit in physics. In fact, right now I'm reading a book about anti-gravity and I just can't put it down. Okay, see, that was bad. And by the way, I am not writing any of these puns. Puns are public domain. A comedian knows you never, ever, ever steal a joke. But puns can't be stolen because they are arrived at simultaneously by multiple people and you never know the origin of a pun. Let's talk more about comedy, more about joke structure, and more about being a writer of humor. Stick around for Mike Sachs. Mike Sachs is a humor writer who has written for Vanity Fair, Esquire, GQ, The New Yorker, Time Magazine, The New York Times, The Washington Post. My God, those are great publications. He has two books out that I think are two of the most important books about humor writing. One is called, and here's the kicker, Conversations with 21 Humor Writers About Their Craft, which I've read and I'm using in my class. It's an amazing book. But his next book is called Poking a Dead Frog. And it is not only interviews, but also essays, advice from some of the country's best comedians, whether they're TV show writers, movie writers, or stand-up comedians. You're going to love this book, and you're going to, hopefully, if you love writing, love this conversation. Mike Sachs, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the title of your book. I think anyone who studies comedy has encountered this E.B. White quote before, but I think what you do with it is awesome. Not only the title, Poking a Dead Frog, if you know comedy or you know about the history of comedy or you study comedy, you know where it came from, but you also include part of the quote that we don't usually encounter. Can you explain it to us?
Sure. Actually, I wouldn't mind reading the whole quote.
Yeah,
as you mentioned, the first part is usually mentioned, but the longer quote is usually not mentioned. And actually, what I did was, I work here in Vanity Fair in Condé Nast. I went down to the New Yorker Library and found the original essay that E.B. White used this quote in. So I don't know if it's that well known, but okay, so this is the original. Humor can be dissected as a frog can, but the thing dies in the process, and the innards are discouraging to any but the pure scientific mind. That's usually where people end,
right.
And then it goes on. Humor won't stand much poking. It has a certain fragility and evasiveness which one had best respect. So what I like about that second part is that, yes, it can be dissected and killed, and that's what he's saying.
Right.
You have to be very careful. It's very sensitive. You can easily ruin the humor of anything. But if it's done properly, then it can be very interesting. And hopefully, that's what I wanted to do with this book, is to not be too academic about it, but delve into what makes comedy work for those who have made a career of it, and very successfully.
And I imagine there's multiple ways to poke a frog. One of the ways would be to, analyze it and try to understand why we laugh at, I don't know if you're aware of Scott Wien's book, Ha!, The Science of Why We Laugh and How, which also he uses this quote, but you're right, he stops at that one moment. There's a way of analyzing it, but there's also a way of poking a frog as a comedy writer to try to find, why something is funny, and even if you're a part of a writing group, to punch it up and make it funnier. And that's kind of a productive way for comedy writers to poke, I would imagine.
Right, and this is, since it's our business, it's not only productive but necessary, because what they have to do day in and day out is show up at a job and produce funny material, whether they're in the mood to or not.
Right.
So by learning about the past, what works and what doesn't, and also by teaching yourself as a comedy writer, you can continue in this very difficult career. But by knowing the past, by knowing, everyone's influenced by something, and the more you're influenced by, the more your writing will sparkle because of that.
Right, absolutely. In our MFA program, we emphasize poetry and fiction and memoir. However, I am introducing a humor element into it for the first time this semester. But of course, one of the things that is basic to being a good poet is to read a lot of poetry, read it and poke the heck out of it until all that's left are the little parts and you forget about the frog itself.
I think that's very interesting, actually, and I think that goes for anything, to know not only what came before you that's good, but what came before you that's not good, so you know what to avoid.
Right.
And I think too many people read the same thing, but I always suggest that you read everything, good and bad, whether it's a book, whether it's a propaganda leaflet, whether it's a advertisement, anything can help you, especially when it comes to comedy. But you just mentioned, too, poetry. And I think there's a real strong connection between poetry and comedy writing. And Terry Jones, actually, from Monty Python, mentioned this, is that there's a conflation, and every word, every syllable, every comma matters in both poetry and comedy writing. So I think, actually, poetry is a great thing to know as a comedy writer. It can only help your writing.
Oh, absolutely, and vice versa. I think learning how to write comedy helps with your poetry because, one of the things that we need to learn as poets and comedy writers is to trim the language, get to the punch, that the more language there is, the more heavy the joke is and the more it's like kind of weighed down.
Absolutely. It's funny where a poem can run three lines, but it can have a density. You can almost feel the weight of it. And a joke is the same way, where you can almost sense that it's solid. But at the same time, you can easily ruin something by overwriting a joke. And I think the same can be hold true for poetry.
Right.
But actually, I do recommend for comedy writers to get a subscription to Poetry Magazine and to go back and read the greats. I think it can only be beneficial. And I think it's actually very underrated. I don't think it's really recommended enough, quite frankly.
Yeah, absolutely. My students are going to love to hear that. As I said, I'm teaching your book, and here's the kicker in the class, and I'm sure they'll be excited to hear you say that, because that's essentially what I'm arguing. If you think about poetry, one of the effects of poetry is the reversal at the end of the poem. And if you think about a conventional Shakespearean sonnet, for example, the last two lines kind of subvert the rest of the, you know, what you've been reading. And in many ways, conventional joke structure is the same way. You set up an assumption and then you subvert the assumption. And just offhand, I'm thinking of Amy Schumer. She has this joke where she says, "I'm dating a new guy from the hills, have eyes." And so she completely subverts the first assumption and replaces it with another, and does it in very pithy way, which is
very interesting. I've never heard that said before, but it's very interesting because I do think you're right. I mean, writing a joke is almost like a magic trick. There's a reveal and there's a surprise, but I never heard it put that way when it comes to poetry, but I think that's very, very accurate.
Let's talk about the structure of this book, Poking a Dead Frog. I'm talking to Mike Sachs, who is not only a comedy writer, but has set out to interview comedy writers, writers of sitcoms, stand-up comics. You even interviewed David Sedaris in your first book, and here's the kicker. But the structure of this book is really interesting. You have interviews, and then you have a section called Pure Hardcore Advice, where I'm assuming you just turn the pages over to a comedian and say, write what you want, and we'll include it.
No, actually. No, it was actually very heavily edited. But it is. I did try to have it. It's always their voice. It's always their words. But I did have to, like, you know, going back to what we were saying about poetry, it has to be heavily conflated, and it has to become dense. And that's what I try to do with that.
Right. And how did you conduct the interviews themselves?
Well, it's a combination of in-person, email, and phone. And, you know, some of these interviews lasted over the course of a year.
Wow.
I would say the average interviews, I mean, certainly not straight, but they would last an average of about 20 hours. And then that would include follow-up questions and everything else. So really, it's the complete opposite of an interview transcript. It's not like a court transcript where it's just a back and forth with no editing. Mm-hmm. It is heavily edited. And actually what I did too is what the Paris Review used to do, and I think they still do. They send the interview to the writer for their sign-off, meaning that if they want to make any changes, if they want to add anything, they can do that. And actually, because these are all writers, they know what an interview needs. They know how to fix an interview if it's not working properly. So that was a big help as well.
Well, you know, that's interesting you should say that, because as I'm reading this book, I'm realizing how much I enjoy reading it. Every part of it is just kind of a pleasure to read. And so even though there's a lot of information, a lot of good tips for, you know, frankly, any kind of creative writer, it does read like a page-turner. And so I imagine, like in the Mel Brooks interview, where he emphasizes the process of rewriting, that there was a lot of work that went into putting this together.
This one, truthfully, this book killed me. it took a year, but a tremendous amount went into it as far as what you just said, as far as flow, because there's a lot of little parts in the book, and I did want it to be almost like a nice piece of music in that there's a melody and there's a flow and there's nothing jarring.
Right.
So I did take a lot of time to make hopefully the interviews interconnect in a sense, whereas one interview would flow into another. If it was an old radio writer, comedy writer, it would flow into a current comedy writer for radio and then, you know, flow into another interview. But yeah, that was very important to me, how it read. And I did want it to read like a book that one would pick up at a bookstore in the airport and just hopefully not be able to put it down.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether I did that or not, I don't know, but it did kill me in the process. I was exhausted by the end of it.
Well, I have anecdotal evidence, of course, how it does indeed do that by the fact that I can't put it down. And I guess there's also some empirical evidence in the fact that the sales seem to be doing really well on this book.
Thanks. Yeah, I think it's on 20th printing or so. I don't know.
Already? Jeez.
Well, you know what? Each print, I was impressed too at first, but then each printing isn't much, so it sounds better than it really is. But it is seems to be doing okay, which
yeah.
I like.
Well, for a literary fiction writer, when my books come out, they usually publish 3,000, and it usually takes maybe 6 months to a year for them to have to do it again. So that is a staggering number, I'm sure, compared to us.
Right, but it's 3,000 of the right people.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about The Simpsons. I think you mentioned this in both books, that more than any other TV show or as much as any other TV show, The Simpsons has a reputation for being led by writers as opposed to producers or network executives telling writers what they want. And that perhaps this is responsible for the fact that 25 years into The Simpsons, every show still seems fresh.
It's incredible. It is a very written show, and I think part of its success has to do with the fact that it was left alone. It was executive free at the beginning of it. The producers said to the executives, "We're going to produce a show. We don't want any meddling." And really, the best comedy has always been executive free, whether it was early Saturday Night Live or Monty Python or any of that, or the UK version of The Office. If you leave writers alone to produce comedy, I think the chances are it'll produce something, at the very least, more interesting than it would have been than if an executive came down and was offended by certain jokes. But you're right about The Simpsons. And also, I think what helps The Simpsons is that it's surreal and it's animated. So jokes that wouldn't work for live action can work for a show like this. And it really is limitless for a writer. I mean, literally, you can think of jokes, you know, about Homer going to the moon, which obviously you can do
right.
in a sitcom.
Yeah, and you have a wonderful interview with James L. Brooks, who is the creator of Simpsons, as well as some other iconic comedy shows. You quote him as saying, "Stay away from our jokes, and we will produce the show of the ages."
That's right. Well, this is a guy who, you know, I don't know why any executive will want to start meddling with this guy's jokes, because he's been involved with some of the best comedy of the last quarter century, if not more. I mean, he helped create the Mary Tyler Moore Show. The list goes on and on. So I think what he did at that point was, yeah, I'll work on an animated show, which may sound silly, but we want to do it on our terms. And what he did was he got these writers who have since become legendary in the business, top writers, who proved, really, that it doesn't matter what the format is. If you have good writing, anything can be lifted up into the realm of art. And as you say, it's still going strong 25 years later, and that's really only due to the fact that the writing is still amazing.
Right, and you talk about how it had some great writers. One of them that comes up in an interview with, I think it was with James Downey. Right, is that his name, James Downey? He talks about John Swartzwelder.
Yes, right.
Who apparently wrote more shows for The Simpsons than any other writer?
Yeah, he wrote, I think, 22. He now writes books that he self-publishes out of California, out of a P.O. Box number. He's a very reclusive guy. He's like Thomas Pynchon. There's very, very few photos of him, and he refuses to be interviewed. But he's sort of legendary in the business that he produced not only more episodes of The Simpsons than anyone else, but a lot of classics, and yet he now refuses to talk about his work or his time on The Simpsons or anything.
Well,
he's one of the few comedy writers who refuses to talk about the work. I mean, most love talking about comedy.
Mm-hmm.
A very strange guy. It wasn't in this book, it was in the first book, where George Meyer, who is one of the greats who wrote for The Simpsons, talked about the fact that Swartzwelder owns the first baseball. He somehow found the first baseball that was ever used. And I don't even know where it is. It may be in a lockbox somewhere, but this is the type of guy we're talking about, just a very odd person.
It's these kinds of moments that come up in the interviews. I love all the sections. I love the pure, hardcore advice and the ultra-specific comedic knowledge where comedy writers are just giving insights into their process or insights into, you know, any aspect of being a comedy writer. But in the interviews, I love how these narratives come out. And so there's this narrative where Downey, he's a writer for the David Letterman show. And the David Letterman show used to accept jokes from anybody that wanted to submit jokes. You can go ahead and submit jokes, and they would actually go through the jokes. And if they found one they liked, perhaps they would use it, and perhaps it would even be a way for a new comedy writer to get a job on the show. And that's how he was introduced to Swartzwelder. Swartzwelder sent in a joke, and I'd like to read the joke if I can.
Sure.
Just one joke on a postcard with only his name and absolutely no information on how to contact him. But the joke was, Mike Flynn's much-publicized attempt to break every record in the Guinness Book of Records got off to a rocky start this week when his recording of White Christmas sold only 5 copies. And not to poke a dead frog, but Mike Flynn, I'm assuming, I didn't know who he was, but I guess he's an athlete. Now, this joke just, Downey became obsessed with it. He would think about it all the time. And so he made a great effort to hunt down the guy who wrote this joke. And I have 2 questions that come out of this. One, and this is where I kind of want to poke the frog a bit. What was it about that joke that just stood out? And two, this idea of TV shows accepting material from anyone who wants to send it in must be, I would imagine, a thing of the past.
Oh, it's totally a thing of the past. I mean, it's up there with Dick Cavett, you know, just walking in with jokes and selling them to the late night host and getting a job off of that. I mean, it's almost like something from a Dickens novel. But the joke that you refer to, the Swartzwelder joke, yeah, it's funny. Certain jokes work well with comedy writers. It's very hard to impress them with a joke or to make them laugh. For some reason, this is the type of joke. It's just very, almost Harvard Lampoon-y. It's very intelligent, and it only appeals to a certain type of person. I don't think it would have worked if Letterman had read it on the air. But the fact that he sent in one joke on a card, as you said, and it made such an impression. I think, quite frankly, the fact that there was just one joke with his name and no information sort of impressed Jim Downey, too. So this is pre-internet. So what he did was he went to the library, and he looked in the Chicago directory, and he ended up finding his John Swartzwelder's mother, then tracking him down, which is just unheard of. It just never goes on. Because what goes on now is that these writers will send in hundreds and hundreds of jokes, sometimes even before the first one is ever purchased for SNL or The Onion or any of these late-night talk shows. So this is just one of those one-in-a-billion occurrences. And that is how Swartzwelder got his start. After he was found, he wrote for SNL, and then he wrote for The Simpsons, and then later became so successful that he retired at a young age and now just writes books.
Well, you know, it's a fantastic narrative, and I think that that particular narrative of Swartzwelder turning in that one joke and then Downey doing everything he can to find him can parallel to the Schwab's drugstore myth of, you know, with Lana Turner sitting there, you know, sucking on a soda and, you know, and a producer saying, I'm going to make you a star, and how it really kind of became a narrative for getting into the business, you know. And I think this narrative actually is very, very important and could reach that status for comedy writing.
Yeah, and I think it does show. I think there's a good lesson there in that it's a very tough business like any business, but it can be done. It has been done. And for every time that it hasn't worked, there's always going to be an exception. So if you do work hard, if you do produce, certainly more than one joke per submission, but if you do produce and your work is good, it'll hopefully be discovered.
Right. Yeah, you mentioned that a good script will be read, period. Do you really believe that?
I do. It's just a matter of who reads it. I mean, oftentimes it can be an editorial assistant who wouldn't necessarily know that it was good, and that's happened with, in some cases, classic movie scripts, Casablanca, have been submitted under a different name to studios or to young readers at agencies, and they passed on it. So I do think that, you know, everything you write, of course, has to be good, but it's not a matter of sending it out once and giving up. You really do have to push. And really, Hollywood is looking for good writing. I mean, that's what drives the business. So I think if you are good, eventually and hopefully you will be discovered.
I'm a fiction writer, and I teach mostly fiction in our MFA program, and I always tell my students that after they graduate, a lot of them just give up after the first 2 years, and I tell them, if you have a good book, eventually it's going to get picked up, and it may take a long time picked up. So I was glad to hear that the same is true in comedy. And the other thing is that you write that in your intro that there has never been a better time for comedy writers, that we're all on equal ground because of social media and because of YouTube, and anyone can make a movie and just put it out there. And it makes me think of comedy writers like Megan Amram. She was a writer on Parks and Recreation, and she just came out with a book called Science for Her, which is doing quite well, and it's absolutely hilarious. She talks about the importance of Twitter, how when she learned how to just do a joke a day, eventually she started to get an incredibly large readership, and how that really helped her career. How important is Twitter for a joke writer?
Well, I don't know if it's just Twitter, but I do think it's everything combined, where it's just an amazing opportunity, where someone like Megan wouldn't have been hired in years past. She didn't go to Harvard. She didn't graduate from the Harvard Lampoon. But here she is writing jokes, not necessarily to be discovered, just writing jokes that interested her and made her laugh,
right,
which is important. And she eventually got on Twitter and got a million or so followers because of the strength of her jokes. Now, that was just on her. It just didn't happen in years past. So when I said that this is the best time, I really do believe it, because it has nothing to do with how rich you are. It has nothing to do with what college you went to. It doesn't have to do with where you live in the country. You can be a 15-year-old girl in your room in Omaha, and you can still be read by as many, if not more, people than a New Yorker article online.
Right.
So I just think that's phenomenal. I mean, I do think having a presence, especially when you first start off, is very important to produce. And Twitter is good in that, in the sense that it's a perfect length for a joke, not necessarily for a short story writer, but for a joke writer, it's a perfect amount of characters, 148. And I do think that the possibility to be discovered off of Twitter is pretty strong.
Right. The fact that there is a character limit really makes you write clean, clean jokes. Well, I wish we had more time, but I'm afraid we're running out. I've been talking to Mike Sachs, whose new book is called Poking a Dead Frog, Conversations with Today's Top Comedy Writers. Plus, I highly recommend, and here's the kicker, Conversations with Top 21 Humor Writers on Their Craft. Mike, I wish you the best of luck, and thank you so much for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Thank you very much. The program down there sounds amazing. I'd love to visit it one day.
Thank you for joining me for this edition of Words on a Wire. Thank you, Mike Sachs, for that fantastic conversation. And I'd like to thank our producer, Norma Martinez, for basically holding the show together. I remember one time I came to Norma and I said I wanted to change our theme song, you know, the I'm up on a higher wire. I thought it would be cool to change it to The Doors, Riders on the Storm. Get it? Riders on the Storm. And she kind of groaned and she says, yeah, maybe not. And so I'm thankful for Norma and her wisdom and experience. I'm Daniel Chacon. Don't forget, the next book you read may save your wife. Okay, sorry.